Welcome to Turn the Page, the official podcast of the Syosset Public Library.
Page, Syosset Public Library's podcast, and you are with Stacy Mencher, Reader Services Librarian.
Evelyn, also Reader Services Librarian.
And Jessica, Community Engagement Specialist and Librarian.
I'm Deanna Rayburn. I'm the author of the Veronica Speedwell series.
Welcome. We're excited to have you. One of the things that we've all pretty much said when we were talking about interviewing you and just the Veronica Speedwell series in general is, I know you're not supposed to judge a book by its cover, but man, the covers are really beautiful.
Yeah, they're very
awesome. Oh, thank you guys so much for having me. Just so that your listeners know, I have a mad crush on librarians. I love y'all. You do amazing work. And if it wasn't for my public library, I would have a very hard time doing what I do. So first of all the library love. The covers are fantastic, aren't they? They are the work of the phenomenal art department at Berkeley, which is an imprint of Penguin Random House. And they just do the most extraordinary covers for this series. And I love them so much. So I got to actually fangirl over the art department because one of the books in the series was nominated for Edgar. And I was up in New York and they threw me a very nice surprise party in the boardroom and invited everybody who works on my books. And the art department showed up and I got to tell them in person how much I really love these covers.
And that was the 2019 awesome. Edgar that you nominated for A Treacherous Curse, is that correct?
Yes, it absolutely was. That was the third Veronica Speedwell book, and it's the one that has kind of an Egyptological theme to it. And that was quite a lovely and unexpected thing to get an Edgar nomination for that book, for sure. Very exciting. It was probably the greatest day of my career. Like I cried and screamed and went running through the house and, people started sending flowers and it was phenomenal to get that nomination.
But let's just tell our listeners a couple of things. One, what an Edgar Award is, and also what your series is all about for Veronica Speedwell.
Well, an Edgar nomination is it's basically the Oscar if you write mystery fiction. It's given out by Mystery Writers of America, and it's pretty competitive, and it's very difficult to get one. When you're partway through a series, and so for book three to be the one to get the nomination was just absolutely phenomenal. The series is the Veronica Speedwell series. It's Victorian mystery. It's not precisely cozy, but it's also not graphically violent. It's not what I would call gritty at all. And the sleuth is an amateur. She's a natural historian who specializes in lepidoptery. She's a butterfly hunter.
My son would love that. My son is obsessed with butterflies.
Well, her partner in detection is another natural historian who specializes in taxidermy, which is one of those things that can be really gross when you start digging into the research. But in Victorian times, they were using taxidermy, and some people still do, they were using them as a means of expressing wealth, but also they were used very frequently for education. And so my taxidermist natural historian is kind of on the forefront of conservation, which was absolutely a Victorian thing, although most people don't realize that. But he is all about conserving and preserving and taking care of animals. So they make for an interesting team.
So what about Victorian times? Because I feel like it lends itself to mysteries very, very well. What about that time period draws you to write about it?
Well, my college degree was, I double majored in English and history because I always knew I wanted to write historical fiction. And I've been out of college for about 25 years. And in that time, I've basically spent all of it reading about Victoriana, especially the female explorers. And I for me, a lot of that is significant because women were out doing things that we don't tend to think of Victorian women were doing. But they absolutely were. The women who were going out and seeing the world, they were engaging in investigative journalism, they were field archaeologists, they were botanists, they were doing all kinds of amazing things. And we don't tell their stories as often as we should. And Victorian times are, I think, comfortably exotic. They're just different enough that we feel like we're taking a journey, but they're familiar enough that we feel like it's accessible. You know, there are a lot of things that we have in common with Victorians. And so it's easy to kind of slip into that world, but at the same time get a complete escape. And, you know, on top of that, there's Sherlock Holmes. So everybody kind of has this automatic gaslit, fog-bound London street fantasy when it comes to mystery fiction, especially if it's historical. Which is a lot of fun to play with.
That's a really thorough answer. I love
it. Yeah, no, that's like very well said.
I was in suspense waiting for the next thing you were going to say. I'm like, and this is amazing.
Yeah.
No, you have to understand, sometimes I roll up to events without knowing exactly what's expected of me. And every once in a while I'm told, okay, so there's 90 people and you're going to speak for 35. No, let's make it an hour. Mm. And that just, it has to be off the cuff. And, you know, so I'm very, very used to doing that. So you kind of will have to rein me in and shut me up.
No. Oh, this is why I think you're like a perfect guest for us, because I feel like that's when we inquiry authors and, like, you know, or guests in general, and they're like, well, what's your interview style? What should we expect? And we're like, that's why I said, you know, before we started this, like, we chat and we like to have a good time.
Yeah. I mean, you know, I had to do, I did an Instagram live event last month after the quarantine started, because my most recent Veronica Speedwell book was A Murderous Relation. That was number 5 in the series. And it launched the first week of March. So I was out on book tour until March 14th, came home, immediately went into quarantine, and still had a couple of online events to do. And so I did one that was Instagram Live, only I'm not so great with the Instagram, and somehow it all ended up cattywampus, and I had to just go live on Instagram for 2 hours with the whole thing open and comments coming in, and just kind of run with it. So I'm fairly bulletproof when it comes to this stuff. So you can throw me whatever you like, and I am happy to try to answer it.
Well, you're doing great with us. Thank you. How much research goes into each one of these books?
Well, you know, there are two different types of research for me. There is the kind of broad base of Victorian research that I, like I said, I've been doing for 25 years. I wrote another Victorian series before this one that had 5 books and 4 novellas in it.
Lady Julia Gray, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And now with Veronica, like I said on that, the 5th book just released. So altogether, I've written more than 1 million words set in the Victorian period. So I have a good base of knowledge, and I'm adding to it all the time, because God bless historians. They're always coming out with phenomenal new research material for me. My TBR stack is like, it's obscene how many books I still have to read. But I'm always trying to keep it fresh, always trying to learn more things. And you know, the more historians discover, the more theories they put out there, the more the narrative changes. So you do have to stay current with it. And then for each specific book, there will be very particular topics that have to be researched. If I have a good base knowledge of poison, but if I'm gonna kill somebody with arsenic, I've gotta go do a deep dive on arsenic. Or if I've got somebody like book 4, A Dangerous Collaboration, was set on an island off the coast of Cornwall, and I had glasswing butterflies in it. So I had to go research, you know, tidal patterns off the coast of Cornwall and glasswing butterflies. And so that's when all the specific stuff gets in. And it kind of, it rolls along as I'm plotting the book out. I'll continue to research, and sometimes I come across something that's absolutely phenomenal and have to put it in. I'm working on Veronica 6 now. I had already turned in the first pass to my editor, found something amazing when I was continuing research, and like immediately emailed my editor and said, yeah, by the way, I found out this really cool piece of information and it's totally going in the book. And so, you know, had to kind of get that in under the wire. So it really never stops. But it's great because this is what I love. I would be reading these books anyway. So now they just kind of get channeled into what I do for a living. So it's
great.
I get, that's the best. That really is the best, isn't it? Yeah.
I get paid to geek out over the stuff I love. but, you know, part of that too is a deliberate choice because I choose to write about things that I enjoy, because if you enjoy researching, then it makes it so much easier. And it all just feels like this wonderful, you know, kind of simmering cauldron of creativity. And you never actually know what's going to bubble to the surface when you're working. And I make sure that I choose subplots or devices or little points of interest that I'm already fascinated with, so that that deep dive doesn't feel like work. It just feels like I get to have a good time.
So you're a Texas girl living in Virginia. How often do you get over to England to find these places?
To do all this research.
Yeah. Do you go over there?
I do. I do. I go over probably once every, I don't know. I was just there last autumn. And then I think my last trip before that had been about 5 years. So not as often as I would like, but often enough to keep things rolling.
Okay.
I mean, if I had my druthers, I'd have a nice little tiny castle somewhere that I'd get to go hang out for a few months every year.
Yeah.
And do you have a readership over there of your books? Do you find that they also love them there?
Very small, actually. I have Veronica Speedwell is not actually published over there. So I have my Julia crew over there. And then the first three books came out in the UK, but the subsequent ones have not. So it's interesting because I'm being translated into Russian and Ukrainian.
Wow.
And yet you can't get the books in England. So that's one of those bizarre little publishing things that happens sometimes. So, you know, hopefully we'll get a publisher over there and I'll be able to kind of build that base, because heaven knows I love going over there.
On your Instagram, you do have a photo from, this is from last year, you posted it, of the Russian editions of Victoria. I can't tell
what it says.
I can't read Russian, but the covers are really beautiful as well.
Aren't they stunning? I don't even have copies of those yet, because it can take months to get your hands on the copies. It was a Russian reader who posted them and tagged me, and that's how I got to see what the covers looked like.
Oh, wow.
Because a lot of times the foreign editions, they just roll up at your house in a package. There's no cover note. There's nothing, because God bless them, they're doing everything they can just to get them to you. And I can't tell you how many times I've had to Google to find out what language I'm looking at. You know, I have to take a phrase from the book and plug it into Google Translate to figure out what's going on here.
That's an impressive bit of Norwegian research as well.
Lithuanian. Though. Yeah. It's always a fun little bit of detective work to figure out, oh, hey, did you know I was in Norway? So yeah, that's always a good time.
Oh, that's cool. Mm-hmm. You know, I noticed that the most recent book is set during Jack the Ripper's reign of terror, I guess is the best way of saying. Yeah. Was it, there? So many times has that been written about. Did you find it kind of difficult to sort of come at it when you knew that that time period has been, you know, written about a lot?
Right. No, I was absolutely adamant that what I was not going to do was write a Jack the Ripper book. Like, excellent. I always swore I was never going to write a Jack the Ripper book, because it has been done so many times.
Yeah.
And because I'm not actually at all interested in finding out who Jack the Ripper was. He was a sociopathic serial killer. I mean, that's all you need to know. I am far more interested in who the victims were as people and how their lives played out. and how they came to be where they were. And so when I looked at the time period, because I kept track of the timeline of the books and where they were going, and you know, the flip side of saying I'll never write a Jack the Ripper book is you can't write a book set in October of 1888 without dealing with it somehow, because of the fact that London was just completely gripped. It was all anybody talked about. It was the news story. Everybody was terrified. It broke down a lot of, it broke London further into factions that had already been there. People were blaming the rich, they were blaming the poor, they were blaming the immigrants, they were blaming the Jews, they were blaming the Catholics. Over and over and over, you see the xenophobia and the racism and the anti-Semitism and, you know, just all these different types of Londoners pitted against each other because they were looking for a scapegoat because they were afraid. And when you're afraid, the easiest thing is to hate what's different and to blame what's different. And so looking at all of that, I didn't want to not write about that because I thought that was fascinating. And luckily for me, right before I started working on this book, a historian by the name of Hallie Rubenhold came out with a book called The Five. And The Five refers to the five canonical victims of Jack the Ripper. And she did a very deep dive into who these women were. And it is a fascinating book. And I hope you guys have a copy of it on your shelves.
I actually would love to read that, I have to say.
That sounds really interesting.
Phenomenal. And one of the things that she has taken an incredible amount of vitriol in some quarters for putting this book out there. She's also been nominated for an Edgar this year for the nonfiction category for this book, because it really does rewrite a lot of what we think we knew about these women. Because the first thing anybody tells you about Jack the Ripper is, oh, he murdered prostitutes. Well, when you read the book, you understand that from all of the research she's done, they were not prostitutes, not in the way we think of prostitutes, because now we tend to think when you hear the word prostitute, a sex worker who does this 24/7, this is her sole means of earning an income. And Hallie Rubenhold broke it down and explained how for these women, sex work was something that they turned to maybe seasonally, maybe, you know, once a week, once a month, depending on when they couldn't make the price of a bed. They would turn to this as kind of a last resort. Otherwise, they made flowers for milliners to put on hats. They went out into Kent and picked hops during the hops harvest. They were fruit pickers. They were, you know, they did all kinds of things to keep the wolf from the door until they couldn't. And then in order to earn the price of a glass of gin to stay warm and to stay full, or to earn the price of a bed, they would go and turn a trick. And so it's much more interesting when you realize how complex their lives were. And the other thing we tend to think of is that these women were born into abject poverty, that they were born the children of perhaps other prostitutes, and they weren't. There is a really amazing kind of through line of there but for the grace of God when you read their stories, and you see that sometimes all it took was the death of a husband and all of their security was gone. And all of their quote unquote respectability was destroyed because suddenly they were thrown onto their own resources and they had none. So what do they do then? How do they manage to survive? How do they support themselves? In one case, it was a woman who just could not come to grips with her need for alcohol. And that led her to make, you know, more and more choices that led her further and further down this path to where she ended up in a situation that nobody should have ever been in at that time. And she ended up victimized by this monster who's roaming around, you know, London's East End. And so it's a fantastic book for anybody who's interested in Victoriana, anybody who's interested in how complex women's lives actually were in history. Because we tend to think in terms of these stereotypes and pigeonholes, and instead what you see is just layers of nuance. So I can't recommend the book highly enough. And that gave me a really interesting in to this story, which is dealing with the idea of women and the complicated choices that they have to make. And the other thing that kind of sparked my imagination is there was a really now debunked horrible theory that came about in the 1970s that a member of the royal family was actually Jack the Ripper.
Yes, I've heard that. Yeah.
He 100% was not. it takes only the most cursory look at the research to realize that, you know, he was not even in London when most of the murders were committed. We know exactly where he was. It was one of those things that was a theory somebody came up with because it was titillating and it's interesting. And as we still know, anything with the British royal family in it sells. Right. And so that's what they were looking for. It was salacious and it sold. It's a terrible theory. It's a crap theory.
You know what? Times haven't changed all that much. I mean, when you, exactly. You know, I'm thinking about all of this and I'm thinking about how, in a way, it was like the social media story of the time.
Yeah, exactly. And so I looked at this story, and even though it was not mooted about at the time, I did want to kind of address the fact that this member of the royal family was an interesting and complex person. It was Prince Albert Victor, who was Queen Victoria's oldest grandson. He would have been King of England if he'd lived. He was the son of the prince who eventually became Edward VII. And he ended up dying in the early 1890s. So he never succeeded to the throne. And he would have been fairly disastrous if he had, bless him. He just was not gifted with a whole lot of qualities that you look for in a king. But he was not a homicidal maniac. So he was another person I was very interested. I really am quite cautious about using actual people from history in my books. But I make an exception once in a while for a member of the royal family because one of my main characters has a loose tie to the royal family. So every once in a while, one of them kind of makes a guest appearance in one of the books. So that kind of all went into the whole cocktail of what I was going to do with this book. And it was so much fun to write. I had a really good time.
I know you said you're working on the sixth. Do you have it planned? How many more books you're going to have in this series?
I'm under contract for 6 and 7. So I turn in 6 at the end of this week and then immediately have to start work on 7. Okay. I also have a contemporary book that I'm under contract for, which I will actually write before number 7. I just have to kind of figure out what 7 is going to be and send that off to my publisher. Write the contemporary, then write number 7. And hopefully we'll have, the sales have increased with every book in the series. Wonderful. And readers really seem to love them. And I would love to keep writing them as long as possible because I think there's a lot of scope for fun things that I can do with them.
And what's definitely. The contemporary going to be?
The contemporary, I just contracted on last month. And it is about 4 60-year-old female assassins who have to band together.
Oh my God, that's like the Golden Girls.
I love that.
The Golden Girls meets 9 to 5 and assassins. So that's awesome.
Yeah, so that one I think is going to be a huge amount of fun to write because these my women are angry. They're menopausal and they're angry.
Okay. I understand.
I mean,
a lot of our patrons would really like that and appreciate it.
Is that going to take place in London too? Where is that going to take place?
That is going to be all over the place. It's got a lot of the action set in New Orleans.
Cool.
And then I think we're going to have a few little minutes in Paris and Rome possibly, and I've got a little Caribbean section, so that one's going to be a lot of fun, I think.
And now talking about contemporary, what are you reading now? I think I saw on your Instagram you and Jessica have something very much in common.
Okay. I was gonna say that, Evelyn.
I just finished the Southern
right
book club,
and she just
to
Vampire. Oh, I haven't even had a chance to open it yet. I'm so excited about reading that book.
It's very good. Yes. It's good.
That's my reward for when I turn my book in at the end of the week, because I get to start it. I'm super excited. That's the carrot I'm dangling in front of myself. I just finished reading The Bookish Life of Nina Hill. I was a little bit late.
Oh, I love that. I like that a lot.
Wonderful by Abby Waxman. Nice. I'm really, this week, Quanah Jackson's book, Real Men Knit, drops. Uh-huh. And it looks, I mean, God, who doesn't want a romance novel with a dude who can knit? Like, that sounds amazing. I mean, I keep picturing, like, Chris Evans from Knives Out, but get a man who can knit his own sweater instead.
Well, I was going to say, did he knit that sweater? Because
exactly. Like, how much better is it that Quanah's got a guy who can knit? And then there's a book coming out this summer that I have the arc for, and I haven't gotten to read yet, and I'm so excited because it's called Mexican Gothic.
I'm dying that one also.
Oh my God. It's by Sylvia Moreno Garcia. And I am such a huge fan of Gothics, and so few people write or publish them anymore. Mm-hmm. And this one just looks divine. And in fact, that it's set in Mexico in 1950, and it's
looks
a traditional
great.
Gothic, and I'm all about that.
You sold me already on that.
I heard it's a bit like it's making the rounds of it's going to be a good book and getting a lot of hype. But you said it very well, Deanna, that like not a lot of people are writing gothics that much anymore.
Well, you know, I it's not that there's not a market for them. It's just that publishers do not really want them. I think a lot of people would write them because I think there are a lot of us who really cut our teeth as readers on Victoria Holt and Mary Stewart and, you know, the Elizabeth Peters books besides the Amelia Peabody series, you know, because she did a lot of things that were somewhat gothic-y under her Barbara Michaels pen name. So I think there are a lot of us who would read and write them if we knew we could get them published. So I'm looking forward to that as well. And then I've also been making up time with when I'm, you know, kind of running around trying to get things done around the house. I've been listening to a podcast that is not new, but new to me, which is She Done It, which is a detective fiction podcast from the UK that I'm completely obsessed with right now.
Oh, wow. That sounds good, too.
Yeah, that sounds fun.
Yeah.
You have so much knowledge. This is wonderful.
Hey, I figured out. That's the one thing you have to do to prepare when you go into any interview. People want to know what you're reading. So. Right.
Oh, yeah.
So I am always all about recommending things that I'm excited about because that is, you know, that's my favorite thing to do on social media too. I never talk about the things I don't like. I only talk about stuff that I love because it's so much fun to cheerlead for projects that you're excited about and to kind of act as a matchmaker for readers and the books that you think they're going to love. It's magic. But you guys
love
that. That's what you do for a living.
Of course we do.
We do.
Yes, we do. We really, truly do.
But no, because when we got your name, I was like, I'd recognize your name because we have a patron that I think she found like one of your books on the shelf and was like, we do a reading program every summer for all ages of the library, but for the adults one. And we do a title swap usually where we all recommend books we love reading. And she goes, so I've never really read her before. And I want to say it was the first book, the Veronica one. And she was just like, yeah, it's really good. I'm getting into it. I'm excited for more. And I was like, this sounds cool to be read, Kyle. So then when they're like, well, do you want to interview her? And I'm like, yes.
This has been really wonderful. Stacey, did you have any other questions?
Yes. I've been needing to interject it because like we've gotten near the topic of my question for a bunch of times, but because you brought up about like Victorian women and not really knowing them and out the victims of Jack the Ripper and understanding them. What do you think makes a good heroine as a character?
Well, you know, I'm not one of those people who thinks that a heroine has to be likable because we so seldom demand that of our leading male characters. To me, a heroine just has to be someone who's interesting. And, you know, whether she's likable or not, I want to explore her conflicts. I want to know what she's dealing with. I do want to find her relatable. She doesn't have to be likable, but I want her relatable. If she's doing something particularly unkind, I want to at least understand why she's doing it and feel like, yeah, on a bad day, I get why that would be your headspace. I understand why you would go there. So for me, that's kind of the benchmark. And that's one of those weird double standards in publishing that I think is starting to get broken down where for a long time people are like, oh, well, I don't find her likable. And like, no, we don't ask. James Bond is not likable. You know, there are a lot of male characters who are iconic, who are not likable, but they're interesting. And so I think that should be the standard for heroines as well.
That's a great answer.
Thank you.
And I like women who are, like when you break it down as far as, to me, the best illustration is Jane Austen. I prefer Emma to Fanny Price any day of the week. I'd rather have somebody who's out there doing things and making a mess than somebody sitting quietly. And Fanny Price has the people who love her, and God bless them. And that's great. She needs to have her supporters. But for me, it's all about the girls who are out there and doing the interesting things.
Yeah.
This has been fabulous.
Thank you so much for having me. I appreciate it. And all the fine folks of Syosset, I hope you are giving your librarians the love in this time. And, you know, they need support. I can't go to my own public library, but I appreciate so much everything they're doing online. They're adding all sorts of digital books to the catalog, so we can check out a whole bunch more things. And it's really, they're doing so much for their community, even though we can't physically go in. So I hope the folks in Syosset are showing you guys the love.
Thank you.
They certainly are. Well, thank you.
We're going to close out this chapter of Turn the Page podcast. Once again, I am Stacey Mencher, Reader Services Librarian with
Evelyn, Reader Services Librarian.
Jessica, Community Engagement Specialist and Librarian. And our guest was
Deanna Rayburn.
Thank you.
Thank you.
It's time to close this chapter of Turn the Page. Join us for the next episode.